This Week in Radio Tech is supported by Violet Microphones, handcrafted in Latvia for generations, on the web at violetusa.com. And by the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource, a reference for broadcast engineers, on the web at thebdr.net.
And now, our feature presentation.
Torrent
works on the principle of an inductor where impedes the rapid flow of energy through it.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up, Dad?
Yeah, all your days are belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
And on this episode, Chris Tard, the Geek Jedi, joins us, along with Tom Ray and our special guest, Hal Neller.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Hey, welcome in to This Week in Radio Tech. It's time for four guys to get together and talk about radio technology. All the things we do in radio studios. Audio, like moving it around from one place to another, getting it across the country, and transmitting it to all those many millions of listeners out there. Hi, I'm Kirk Harnack. I'm your host for the show. And we have a couple of co-hosts with us. As usual, from the Hudson Valley of New York, it's Tom Ray. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Kirk, how you doing?
I'm good. It's good to see you. You made it home just in time for the show.
Yeah, which is always a good thing, and my daughter was getting a bassoon lesson tonight, and she's finished, so we won't be hearing the bassoon in the background, and I am Vice President of Engineering for Buckley Broadcasting, work out of WOR Radio here in wonderful New York City, in the New York area.
A big 50,000-watt blowtorch at 710 on your dial.
That's right.
By the way, if your daughter was playing the bassoon, you know, at the Twit Network, they have now the technology to remove all sounds of vuvuzelas.
That's so, a good thing. Let me tell you, that is a good thing.
I think Burke could adjust that to remove a bassoon as well.
Well, let me tell you. I'd like to get a hold of one of those because right now she's learning. She's an accomplished flute player, but bassoon is a new thing.
Oh, my gosh. It's a completely different size, too. Hey,
as big as she is, let me tell you.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. Hey, let's check in with Chris Tarr. Hi, Chris. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm here at Stormageddon Central 2010. We've got some storms coming through a little later on, so I've got one eye on Skype and one eye on the radar here to see what's going on. I am Chris Tarr, Director of Engineering for Intercom Stations in Milwaukee and Madison.
Well, good deal. Well, this show is right up the alley for both Tom and Chris. Tom and Chris are both very much what I would call hands-on engineers. Get their hands dirty and actually make things work, fix things, install new things. And every once in a while, I do that too. And so this show is about troubleshooting and installation, not necessarily in that order. We also have someone who's joining us by voice only. He's not on video, but that's okay. Most people listen to the podcast. It's our dear friend from Punta Gorda, Florida. It's Hal Neller. Hello, Hal.
Hello, Kirk and everyone. And I have a great face for radio. That's why I have no video.
We're glad you're here. Hal, we're going to have you chime in a little bit later in the show as you tell us about some of the technology that is changing and adapting and some of the ways that we're able to transmit digital HD radio and do it with less chance of interfering with other stations. So there's some really cool technologies, and also doing it at a higher power level. I know we've covered this a little bit in the past, but Hal's now got more and more experience under his belt and some real-world stories to tell us about. Hey, I'm going to kind of kick things off here with a little story from what happened to me over last weekend, Saturday. I was charged with visiting one of the radio stations that I own in Mississippi, and we've had some trouble with the transmitter there. So a transmitter is about 11 years old. In fact, maybe, Burke, if you could actually bring up about the last picture or one of the pictures of the full transmitter that I sent to you, we could have a quick look at that. These pictures, by the way, for listening to the audio podcast, I'll put these pictures on the website. On the This Week in Radio Tech website in the show notes. There we go. That is the metering panel of about an 11-year-old FM transmitter made in Italy by a company called RVR and then resold in the U.S. under the Armstrong name. And it's given us pretty good service over the years. It has to sit and run in a very hot, horrible environment. In fact, Burke, there's a picture of the transmitter site with my Forerunner sitting out front. Maybe you could bring that up. It's in the middle of a bean field. This poor transmitter has lived its life in the midst of a lot of Arkansas and Mississippi dust and dirt and mud. And there we go. That's my forerunner just last Saturday, sitting in front of the cramped and tiny little cinder block or concrete block transmitter building, which is WKXY-FM. So why did I have to go there? Well, we've actually we had a problem. We had a tube failure in that transmitter. Let me kind of set this up, because I know there are some people who listen to this podcast who are not really who are not engineers or don't take care of a transmitter. Maybe they do some studio work. Maybe they're just enthusiasts or interested. So I'm going to kind of take you through this, what happened. And if you are an engineer, we'll get through the boring parts. And if you're just an enthusiast interested in FM transmitter sites, this is a pretty typical small town situation that I'm taking care of at my station in Cleveland, Mississippi. So we have this transmitter site. It's actually, if you want to look it up, the transmitter site is about a mile east of Mound Bayou, Mississippi. There's looking at the stormy sky back toward Mound Bayou. This is just east of U.S. Highway 61 as it traverses the down the west side of Mississippi. So we have a station there. It's WKXY-FM. You can listen to it on the internet. I think the website is kix92.1.com or kix921.com. I'll have to check that out and make sure. Maybe somebody can check that out while I'm here, sitting here yapping. So we have this transmitter, and it's suffered a few failures over the years. Kind of a persistent problem has been the blower motor. Apparently, the blower motor directly drives on the same shaft that drives a squirrel cage blower and blows a whole lot of air through the tube cavity. The tube cavity, this transmitter, by the way, is a 3.5 kilowatt transmitter. Oh, that's the backside of what I installed. If you can get another shot of the whole front of the transmitter, Burke, that'd be good. This transmitter... it's an FM transmitter, so there's an FM exciter involved, and we need to feed the tube with a drive of about 225 watts. It's a grounded grid design, so it's extremely stable. There you go. Bring that up a little bit there, Burke. This is a picture, and it'll be on the website, too, of the that's all the equipment at the transmitter site. In fact, we'll describe a bit about what's going on here. In the cabinet, the rack on the right-hand side, at the top, this is a Bird watt meter. And we can monitor the forward and reflected power from a very accurate sample that's in the transmission line. Then the next thing down is the microwave receiver. We call it an STL or studio transmitter link receiver. That one happens to be made in Italy, also by RVR. And I believe that one may be branded under the Armstrong name. So this is a receiver that's picking up a signal at about 950 megahertz. It's an FM signal. It's about 6 or 7 watts being generated at the studio site and then received with... probably about a little under a millivolt of signal coming into the back of that thing. There's a parabolic reflector antenna up on the tower that is receiving that signal and bringing it down some half-inch coax, which is about as low loss as we can get for that kind of money. And then also in the rack, the next thing down is a remote control system. It's a telephone dial-up remote control. It speaks voice to you, and it can meter some characteristics at the transmitter site, like the temperature in the site, also, the different characteristics of the transmitter, like the forward power, the reflected power. There's also a sample for the plate voltage. This is the high voltage that's applied to the tube. And then there's also a sample for the plate current, how much current the tube circuit is drawing. And the plate voltage times the plate current times the efficiency of the transmitter should give us the power output in watts. And that should equal the direct reading of power in watts that's done on the Bird watt meter. Then also in the rack... a little bit lower down is the backup FM exciter. This is the one that I actually just replaced. This was the original FM exciter that came with the transmitter. It's capable of putting out 100 watts. Normally, it was run at about 10 or 15 watts. It's actually over in the right, Burke, in the right-hand side. That's that thing with the LCD screen on it and the round knob. That was the original FM exciter that came with the transmitter. Now, as we discussed in a previous episode, remember the FM exciter... is what actually turns the audio that we're feeding it into RF that's modulated on the FM band. So what goes in is multiplex or baseband audio. It's the entire left plus right stereo pilot and left minus right signal. And then the exciter puts that audio onto, in this case, 92.1 megahertz, which is the frequency of WKYX. So coming out of the exciter, in the way the transmitter was originally built, since that tube needs about 200 and some watts of drive, the exciter, the 100-watt exciter, wouldn't have been enough. So that transmitter had a 300-watt solid-state transistorized amplifier. It used MOSFET transistors in it to take about 10 or 15 watts input and turn that into 300 watt, up to 300 watts of output. We would usually run it at just a little over 200 watts, and that would drive the grid circuit. I'm sorry, the filament circuit of the tube. It's a grounded grid transmitter. And the tube has a gain of in the neighborhood of 10 dB or so. That's pretty typical for a grounded grid design. And so the transmitter would amplify that by 10 dB, and we'd get or 10, 11, 12 dB, something like that. We'd get about 3.2 or 3.3 kilowatts of RF out of that transmitter. Well, so the story is that we had some difficulty with that exciter. It being 10, 11 years old, it had some flakiness, would cut out occasionally. We really couldn't find the problem with it. So, also, the 300-watt amplifier had died, and it was getting long in the tooth, time to replace it. So what we decided to do, I really wanted to buy a new transmitter, but my financial partner in the radio station said, no, we don't have the money for that right now, so let's fix what we got. So we bought a new tube, and we also bought a new exciter that is capable of putting out 300 watts. It happens that we had several to choose from. It just so happened that we chose the exciter made by Nautel. It's a new design, and there's the tube. That is the brand new tube that I had to replace. You see the marking on there. It's a 3CX3000A7. The first three indicates that it's a triode tube. It has a filament, a grid, and a plate or an anode. The plate is where the high voltage is applied. Also, the plate is that great big structure there that everything is printed on. All that is heat sink. It really doesn't do much other than be a heat sink with fins on it that the air can blow by. The CX means it's a ceramic tube. The X might mean something that I don't know about. And the 3,000, that number is the number of watts that the plate is capable of dissipating in terms of heat. Doesn't really indicate how much RF power it's capable of putting out. Hope I've got that right. Somebody jump in and just slap me if I'm wrong. And then the A7 has something to do with some characteristics internal to the tube. So 3CX3000A7, fairly common tube for this level of FM station, but a lot of these transmitters are being replaced by solid-state transmitters. There was also a code on the side of that tube. It said 0944, and that is a date code. It was manufactured in 2009 during the 44th week of 2009. So that's give you an indication of that. There's also a serial number on the tube. You see, there it is. Thanks, Burke. It's etched into the filament connector, one of the filament connectors on the tube. And so I can't quite read. It's AK something 005 or 7 or something. I always take note of what the serial number is and write it on a permanent log that stays at the transmitter side. By the way, let's stay on that picture, and you can see that serial number is etched into one of the contacts of the filament. There's another contact the other side. You know, the filament is a complete circuit. It's AC power goes in and comes out. There's a pin that is up inside that round structure, and the tube sets in from the top and shoves down onto a socket. And the socket is made of very substantial spring metal, spring fingers that provide a lot of physical contact area to.
If they're like transmitters I've had, you set it down into a bunch of bent pins, is what you do. A bunch of broken fingers.
Which are always a lot of fun to replace.
Right, which are, yeah. They're supposed to look like kind of like this, and they're like that, and they're broken half.
Chris, you're supposed to replace those.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh. See, now I've just been, I've just been kind of just cramming it down in there until it fit. All right, well, I guess I better go get some new ones then.
Yeah, but, Chris, replacing those things called fingers helps you improve your vocabulary. It enhances it.
I remember the last time I replaced some of those, I learned some new swear words. I do remember that.
That's what I mean. There you go. See?
Hey, how many of you have ever taken a tube socket, completely unbolted it from the transmitter deck, and just taken it all apart right there at the transmitter site?
Oh, yeah. I have.
Oh, yeah. Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So these two... These tube sockets sometimes have capacitors that are inbuilt or soldered in very closely with very short leads. Sometimes they have little capacitors that are made with plates with Kapton or Teflon separating the plates. So these tube sockets can be a little bit mechanically complicated. Well, this one
and they're also, they also cram them into a small space. And I find I have with me one of the, like a dentist mirror, kind of a curved mirror, so I can actually hang it down under so I can see what I'm doing underneath the socket. Because you also get a lot of screws and bolts.
You know, the first time I ever saw a tube socket all taken apart, I was at an FM station in Tupelo, Mississippi. And I had a guy there with me who had complete confidence about taking this tube socket apart. Again, for listeners, this is the tube socket. It's this round thing that sort of looks like an upside-down wedding cake that the tube and all its various parts squeeze down into. And it has to transfer a lot of electricity, a lot of signal into and out of the tube. Usually, in this particular tube, the 3CX3000, there's two filament connections that are very high current. In this transmitter, they may be on the order of 15, 20, 25 amps of current at about 7 volts AC. But in bigger transmitters, this can easily be more like 70 amps of current to drive the filament. A whole lot of current going on there. And in addition to the AC current that is feeding the filament and making it light up and letting electrons, you know, be able to jump off of it, there can also be a lot of RF signal on this filament, depending on the design of the tube. This is a grounded grid transmitter, so there is RF, that 225 watts of RF coming from the exciter, is applied to the filament of the tube. The grid of the tube is like a controlling device in this kind of transmitter. It's actually grounded, and so it provides a fixed amount of gain. And then there's the plate or the anode that has this huge high voltage on it. This transmitter, about 6,000 volts of DC, and that just attracts the electrons like crazy that are floating around the filament because it's on and hot. And I'm making a real layman's explanation here, but basically we get a huge amount of amplification because of the power that's available on the plate of the tube. You know, 6,000 volts at over an amp of current. So 6,000 watts are available there, and then you take the efficiency factor of the transmitter and you end up getting about 3.3 kilowatts out. So what I ended up having to do was to replace the tube, which also involves, I didn't get a picture of it, but also involves removing an air chimney off the top of the tube. So this involves undoing some, the name's slipping. What are those bands called, those metal bands that have a screw to pull them tight?
Hose clamps.
Hose clamps, yes, great big, and of course we lost the original hose clamp that was this big around, so we have like three different hose clamps in series all around the collar of the tube. So you have to loosen that up, and then you push this whole collar and chimney up, okay, up higher in the transmitter, and this allows you to grab the tube and wiggle it very small amounts at first. It's in there really tight, and so you wiggle the tube out, and finally you pull the tube out. Now you have to be careful with these tubes, even a new one, because I don't know if this is really true or not, but the folks at some of the tube rebuilding companies, and maybe iMac, who's a manufacturer of new tubes, says that the consistency of the filament of a tube is not too different from the consistency and fragility of a burned matchstick. You guys ever heard that before?
I haven't heard that one yet. But
no, I haven't either.
Well, they said no. Be careful. It's, you know... tubes are shipped. They're packed in foam and then put in a box, and there's foam around that, and then there's another box. So they're double packed and lots of foam. The box that tube is about 8 or 9 inches tall or so, and then probably 5.5-6 inches around at the big point. But that came in a box that's big enough to probably as big as 6 concrete blocks. I mean it's a great big box. So. Fragile inside. So here I am being real careful with this. So the new tube, I look in there, see if there's any fingers that are broken or bent. Chris, in my case, there weren't. Well, it's all in good shape.
Well, lucky you.
Actually, this tube socket, Chris, is of a different design. I've seen these in grounded grid transmitters. They tend to use tube sockets that have very thick and stiff fingers, as opposed to tube sockets that I've seen in transmitters made by, say, Harris or BE or Continental, where you've got a lot more fingers, but they're maybe silver and they're springy material, but they break off a lot more easily. These, it's real hard to break one of these off because they're pretty thick, but they're also, it's real hard to get the tube down in there. Hey, how many of you have had to use a 2x4 to leverage a tube down into a socket?
No, no, I haven't had to do that, but I have had to with one particular brand of transmitter. I have had to like contort myself and turn the tube upside down to get it into the door, and then kind of flip it over and then put it back in the right place.
Yeah.
And, oh boy.
You remember what transmitter that was? I've had to do the same thing. I want to say it was
A Harris FM25K.
That's it. Yes, indeed. I've changed the tube on that sucker.
And it's
too.
Worse
you gotta,
when you're at
gotta
the...
You got to put it upside down of all things. And then while it's just hovering over the tube socket, flip it over. Is that right?
Yep. It's not bad once you're below about 100.5 in frequency. But boy, if you're above 100.5, that's when you get into the contortion act. It's unbelievable.
Oh, is that because the tube cavity is smaller and smaller because of the higher frequency?
Exactly. Because they bring that top shelf down. And when they bring that top shelf down, you can't maneuver the tube anymore. So now you have to flip it over and such. And I used to cheat and just pull all the screws out and pull the whole back off the cavity and just put the stupid tube in and be done with it.
There you go. So just to finish this story up a bit, we replaced the tube, did some blowout, clean out, put the back of the tube cavity back on. This is a very tight, sealed up cavity with some mechanics in there, some mechanical stuff, and motors that can run the whole plate up and down that sets the size of the thing. And also there's a motor that runs the plate loading capacitors together to get more or less loading on the tube circuit and transfer that power then to the output. Or the antenna that's going on. So, got that all done. Ran the filament voltage for a little while because you're supposed to do that. Supposed to help burn off any gas that's still inside the tube, anything that may have been left over from the vacuuming forming process. And while I was waiting for that to happen, I pulled out of the box this beautiful brand new Nautel 300 watt exciter. Burke, maybe you can find a picture there of the box or of the exciter itself. This is a new exciter made by Nautel, the VS300, and thank goodness for me, for our little station, this is kind of a value series. It's rather low priced compared to some of the fuller price stuff. So this is a new series that Nautel came out with, and other manufacturers too are having some value priced series as well. So that's the front of it. You see on the screen, pictures on the website or will be, and then on the back of it, let's have a look at some of the connectors on the back there, Burke. This exciter is capable of communicating with quite a few different things. We're using the multiplex input because we're sending a composite signal. The multiplex input is actually in a different. But here's the output though. This is the RF output is on that N connector on the back, so you get up to 300 watts out of that connector. Then there are a couple of connectors for taking samples of the RF if you need to feed a modulation monitor or you need to feed some other kind of sampling device. There's also an Ethernet connection right there, so you can give this thing an IP address and connect it up to a network so you can remote control it. And there are some contact closures, some GPIO ports for giving you sample readings and also closures to turn the transmitter on and off. Hey, Burke, there should be a picture of the other end of that of the back as well. Where there's most of the audio connections are over on the right-hand side. Like I said, I use the multiplex connection, but if you have an AES EBU digital signal that's already gone through an FM processor, you can use that. I think you can get an FM processor that is built into this, made by Orban, a competitor to my employer. You can get a processor built in. There's also a live wire port. You see the Burke, show that again, that other Ethernet port on the back, it's labeled LiveWire, and so that port will talk to an IP audio network like the Axia LiveWire network. So you could send processed audio into the exciter that way. And you see there's other ports there for different kinds of inputs and outputs. And the power and then the big honkin' switch that has a circuit breaker inbuilt to that. So that's the back of it. Now, Burke, you can probably find a picture of the whole thing, the whole rack together, or that picture with the cables coming out the back. One thing that Nautel is pretty good about is supplying accessories along with their products that just help you get the installation done. And some of the accessories that they send along are quite useful. Some of those accessories are these big toroidal chokes. You can see them there in the front of that lower left-hand part of that picture. They encourage you to use these toroids and pass your AC cable through it and your audio cable and even your RF output cables. This helps prevent lightning and other surges from entering in a common mode, at least common mode, into the back of the exciter. Either it's input or keep surges from hitting it from either way. So these toroidal Chris, you got experience with these toroids and how they work and how effective they are?
Oh, absolutely. Especially again since Natal sends them with all of their transmitters, and now this is a matter of practice. Whenever I do any kind of installation, I use those, and the experience so far, obviously, I've had no problems, which either means I've just been lucky or they work. But really, you know, I put them on everything. Any line that goes in or out of a transmitter, either power, control, audio, anything, I now put through those toroids. And I'll tell you, I really haven't. The one thing I can tell you is before I did that, I would occasionally have an issue where we'd have a lightning storm come through and have a piece of gear in the studio somewhere along the audio chain fail. That hasn't happened anymore. So I tell you that they work.
Yeah. I've been I guess Nautel's been supplying those for quite a long time. I remember getting some with an original, I guess it was I can't remember the model number now, it was NB1 or something. It was a 1 kilowatt transmitter in a full-size rack and came with those. And that was my first experience with putting toroids onto the audio, power, and RF feeds going in and out of the transmitter. And come to think of it, I never had any problem with that transmitter either. So these toroids really work. Hal will join us here. In fact, Hal's here right now. Hal, what can you tell us about these toroids? I think they're very interesting that such a simple-looking device can quench surges.
Absolutely. You know, I put my first Nautel transmitter in 1986. That was an AmFET 5, and it came with a bag of those things to put across basically everything that was in or out, including, by the way, the RF transmission line. It works on the principle of an inductor where it simply impedes the rapid flow of energy through it.
Or it impedes changes in the magnetic field, changes in the flow of energy.
Exactly. So a lightning surge or power line surge or whatever would be impeded. And they don't, if you're dealing with a wire thickness that's such, they recommend that you actually put the wire through and then loop it back through an additional time or two because that even adds more protection.
Sure. I'm not sure if it doubles it each time you go through, but there's an equation that's probably pretty close there. You're sort of making a part of a transformer there. There's the picture again of my AC power cable running through two toroids that they supplied. And in fact, they supplied a total of four of those great big toroids. And then they supplied about four or eight of the smaller ones. And I used those on the MPX audio feed. So that's really pretty cool. And that's the kind of thing that most engineers wouldn't take the trouble to go buy on their own, to go look up and buy. Now, ham radio operators, I know, oftentimes use toroids. In fact, they're advertised in the back of, say, QST magazine. So there are plenty of RF engineers familiar with using these and how they work. But I think it's just great that a manufacturer would include those in the installation kit. So just finishing
and,
up the story.
You can buy them from surplus houses quite inexpensively, like Surplus Sales of Nebraska and other ones. And they're very inexpensive, and they're about the least expensive item you can do to improve your surge protection.
That's a good point. I'm thinking of other places I need to install those. And you're right, Surplus Sales of Nebraska does sell those things.
And not only that, I always keep actually a lot of toroids in my toolbox just for different situations because, again, they're, as hams know, they're great for getting RF out of places where they shouldn't be. In fact, a story I had a while back, I have an FM and an AM co-located, and all of a sudden I started hearing spurs about megahertz and a half up and down from my center frequency of my FM. And I, for the life of me, couldn't figure out what was going on. Well, my AM station is 1,250 kilohertz. So what was happening was some RF from the AM transmitter was getting into the exciter through the audio lines, and the exciter was amplifying that 1,250 kilohertz signal up and down, creating spurs. And a real simple solution, grabbed a couple of toroids, wrapped my audio lines, my MPX lines going into the exciter through that, problem went away. So, you know, whenever you have noise on telephone lines or you have equipment that's kind of just acting hinky, I always keep a whole bunch of toroids in my box just for that, you know, just for that purpose.
Oh, it works great. We have an exciter at our station, one of our, at our FM in Hartford. We've got about, I'm going to say seven Class B FM stations in close proximity up on Meriden Mountain. And I ended up putting toroids on every single line going into and out of this exciter because we were having all kinds of modulation spikes and everything else. And calmed it right down. And I've got them all over my weather station here at home from that's attached to my ham APRS stuff because whenever I get up on certain HF frequencies, it just kind of all of a sudden decides it's having a wind gust of 130 miles an hour if I don't do that.
Wow. Wow. Well, so just to wrap the story up, I put this exciter in. I had to program it. It comes, I think it came tuned to 98.1, but no fear. Easy to reprogram from the front panel, as many FM exciters are nowadays. And I didn't know how much power I was going to need to put out of it. And also, I wasn't sure about if it was going to handle reflected power very well and if there was going to be some reflected power. The previous tube had given us quite a bit of a poor match at 50 ohms, and so we were getting some reflected power back. To the previous amplifier. So, hey, Burke, there's a picture of the front panel with the LCD up really close with numbers and such on the LCD. So I slowly cranked the power up on this 300-watt amp exciter. As I did so, I had to tune the cavity that the tube was sitting in because every tube is going to have slightly different characteristics. There we go. That's the picture I'm looking at. So you can see I tuned it to 92.1. And this was when I finally found the sweet spot, found how much power it really needed. We ended up feeding the tube with 224 watts of power, and we were getting 4 watts reflected back from the tube circuit. There's no way to tune this particular tube circuit in this transmitter, so whatever we get back, that's what we get back. And which I thought that was pretty good actually. So the exciter's happy, the transmitter's happy, and it's putting out a full 3,250 watts, which is what that station is licensed for. So it's sitting there. It's been running since Saturday when I was driving away from the transmitter site. I do have a new radio in my 4Runner, but I tell you what, the station sounded really nice, very sweet. The high end was so clear. The bass sounded awesome. And so I was just really happy with the way it all turned out. Finally, Burke, go back to the picture of the whole place with the exciter sitting on top of the transmitter. What I ended up doing was I put a blank panel in the front of the transmitter where the old 300-watt exciter used to be. That's down a bit lower, actually, where the Kix 92.1 bumper sticker is on the panel. And then right under the exciter there, I put two 1-rack unit panels to cover that up as well. That's where the original exciter was. The Nautel exciter was too deep to fit in the transmitter. I wanted to put it in there, but it was about 6 or 7 inches too deep and just wouldn't go back in the same spot.
Hold up.
There's
hold
the whole
up,
transmitter.
Hold up, hold up.
Yeah.
Kirk, I don't see no duct tape on those panels there. You didn't put those in.
Yeah,
right.
There's a problem here. You got to use duct tape. Come on.
You need to stick those panels on with duct tape. What's going on?
I don't know where I can get duct tape on a Saturday afternoon in Mound Bayou, Mississippi. I might be able to get it from Smitty's, which is at the only flashing light in Mound Bayou. But I didn't have any duct tape, sorry. And I also I felt bad about having to set the Nautel exciter on top of the transmitter. There's room there for it. It's not going to go anywhere. I wanted to put it in the rack. People say, oh, why did you put it in the rack? The rack right next door. Well, the rack's not deep enough, and the Nautel exciter requires mounting rails in the back of it. They provide the complete kit, but I didn't have any place in the back of that rack to attach those mounting rails, so I couldn't put it in the rack where I really should have put it, so it had to go where you see it now. It had to go
well,
on
Kirk,
top.
Down on those parts, you see how they put the air conditioners outside the windows and kind of prop them up with a 2x4 in the back?
Yes.
That's how you
see,
do it.
Now that's what I would have done. I would have had it hanging out the back side of the window.
We don't have an air conditioner at the site because if we put one in, it would be gone.
From looking at the site, I thought you were going to say if you put one in, there'd be no more room in the building to get in.
That but, too.
Anyway.
But it'd be gone because Mama needs an air conditioner.
And, oh, jeez.
Yeah, that part of the world, air conditioners don't last real long. A lot of stores and even people's houses, their air conditioners, they put custom bars around their air conditioner, like people put bars over their windows in some cities. So there you go. That's the site. I'm sorry for we got a crew coming out to take down all the extra ivy and such. But that's WKXY. So enough about that. I just thought it was you know, I haven't gotten to do some good engineering there lately. Usually I go down there and I've, you know, clean the viruses off the computers and just tweak up the automation, make sure everything's working that way, and check the audio processing. But I actually got to go do some real, by golly, engineering there at the site. So hey,
don't read our
Hal,
notes while we're sitting here making fun of you.
Pardon?
Don't read our notes while we're sitting here making fun
of you. Yeah, I'm reading your notes here. Guys, have your own chat room. So Hal's here to talk to us about, and I don't mean to leave any stories like Chris or Tom may have, if there's something that you need to interject. Gee, I'm sorry. I took 30 minutes here telling that story. Hal is here to discuss some what he's recently found out and got some experience with in terms of HD radio. It's something that they're calling differential sidebands, differential power in the sidebands, and what stations also are doing with this allowed HD radio power boost. So, Hal, why don't you talk to us a bit about these subjects?
Okay, great. Thanks, Kurt. You know, the FCC a few months ago allowed the FM stations who are not the Super Bs or Super Cs, meaning that they exceed the power normally allowed in their class. But almost all FM radio stations, let's put it that way, except for that small group, to increase their HD power from 1% of the analog to 4%. And that's across the board, again, with the exception of those superpower stations. The stations were further allowed to increase their power up to 10% of the analog if they could do a showing at the FCC that a formula that was developed by NPR Labs, that they were in compliance with this formula for interference. Well, it turns out that a fair number of stations found out they had a conflict on either one or the other of their sides, either the upper or lower adjacent, which prohibited them from going past the minus 14 dBc or the 4% to get to that higher 10% level.
Now,
so,
what sort of market would this conflict typically take place in? What size market? We're talking about New York, Philadelphia, where things are pretty short spaced up anyway?
All over, big markets and small alike. I did a presentation for the SBE in Miami a couple of months ago, so I ran with the help of a calculator that's not up on the web anymore that NPR had up there. And I ran all the Miami stations, and I found out about 10 of them could go to minus 10 with no problem. There were about six that could go to 10 and 14. Some on the upper sideband had an issue, some on the lower. So there were at least a half a dozen stations in Miami that could benefit from what we call asymmetrical sideband power or differential sideband power. So when you make your showing, you might find you're limited to minus 14 on one side. The other side perhaps could either go all the way to the minus 10 or to something in between. So by using what's called asymmetrical power in the sidebands, you could set the amount of energy in each of those sidebands to comply with whatever your particular station scenario was. Now,
just to be clear, when you say sidebands, these are on either side of the regular FM analog carrier. So let's say we got a station at 98.1, and it's taking up plus and minus 75 kilohertz of analog audio deviation of that carrier. Then we've got an HD radio sideband below that in frequency, an HD radio sideband above that in frequency, and there might be an adjacent station either below or above that these HD sidebands, one of them may end up causing some interference with. Do I have that scenario correct?
Yes, you have it exactly right. In fact, the HD carriers pretty much fall into the first adjacent or 200 kilohertz out from the, we'll call it the host analog station. So that is why the first adjacent needs to be studied to go past the 4% level. And it's going to be very handy for a lot of stations. Now, I should say that at the moment, the FCC does not allow this as standard operating practice, but we can also say that when HD radio started being rolled out in the country, they didn't allow separate antennas for digital and analog. But you could go to them and get a special temporary authorization to do that. After they had a little experience with it and they formed a committee who made some recommendations as to the parameters that the second antenna had to have it eventually became part of the FCC rules. So now, if you so choose, so long as you're compliant with those rules, you may put your HD on a second channel. If you wish to go with this asymmetrical sideband on your station, you would do this showing, and you would go to the FCC and request an STA, and they will come back, and they have already told us that, you know, they will grant these provided you do the showing. Now, eventually, Ubiquiti is going to release code that's going to allow most of the transmitter manufacturers to offer the differential sidebands. Nautel did demonstrate at the NAB this product and is actually being sold at this time. So that all goes along with something called HD Power Boost, which also includes an enhanced peak to average power ratio reduction system that allows more power out of the transmitter and slightly higher operating efficiency. In the course of doing this, what's called HD Power Boost, they have to assimilate and then recreate the HD radio sidebands on either side of the analog signal. And in the course of that recreation, they are able to tailor the amplitude of those to whatever the customer might need. So that's how we're able to accomplish this ahead of the Ubiquiti code release.
That sounds like a lot of statistical analysis to do this power boost. We've talked about that on a couple of previous shows. In fact, you may have mentioned this with us as well. And we also had Chuck Kelly on to help us understand this thing about when you want to boost HD radio power, you can get occasional peaks when a number of carriers coincide, and your HD radio transmitter is required to put out an enormous amount more power than it normally is putting out. Hence the peak to average ratio.
That's right. So, it's vector math is what it is. If you remember vectors, you know, from school. You know, they can be additive or they can be subtractive. But the way it works in the existing system is Ubiquiti has a PAR program, a peak to average ratio reduction program built into the HD radio system. And that's a part of the HD exciter. It, however, only acts upon the digital portion. It does not act upon the analog portion. So what we have done is turned off Ubiquiti's PAR and then taken the entire envelope of analog plus HD and created our own PAR, which allows, sometimes this addition is helpful, so we don't have to do as much peak reduction, and at other times where it's destructive, we have to take more off. But it's allowed us to increase the efficiency, basically because we've reduced the peaks.
Might you actually reduce the analog power for a very brief instant? So that
no.
the digital? Okay. So that,
no,
that's
you wouldn't want to do that. I mean, it's instantaneous or fairly instantaneous, but that might get into violation of FCC rules.
Yeah,
having, I'll call it AM modulation of your FM carrier.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to do that purposefully. But you can with the differential sideband powers, as you were talking about earlier. I guess you can take energy that would have had to go to producing, say, an upper sideband that you've decided is going to stay at a 1% power level or minus 20, you can take some of the power that would have been used to generate more power there and put it on your leftover sideband, the lower sideband?
Yes, you can do that. It all comes out of the transmitter's power reserve, but obviously if you're not generating as much HD signal on the lower sideband, it won't derate the transmitter as much. And as we increase the HD power levels, we have to derate the transmitters more.
So the stations that you've had some experience with, those that are perhaps doing this differential sideband power, what are you finding out in the field? Are receivers behaving properly with this?
Well, the first station that's going to go on with this in a real live on-air environment is WAMU in Washington.
We'll find out.
It's not on the air yet. However, there is a legally licensed radio station in Hackett's Cove, Canada, which is near Halifax. And it's duly licensed by the Canadian regulatory agencies, and it's several hundred watts. And so this has been tested in live on-air environments there with various receivers, and also some of you may know Philip Schmidt, who is the guy who is really the brains behind the process that Nautel has done here. He's done quite a lot of laboratory testing with the different receivers and whatever, and has not found deleterious testing. We're going to be doing some independent lab testing and, of course, the on-air test with WAMU to verify this. But the test that they're finding is that if you do a minus 10 and a minus 14, the resultant coverage is looking like it's going to be very close to what you would have if you had a symmetrical minus minus 12.
Okay. All right. So yeah, that kind of makes sense. So Chris Tarr and Tom Ray, are you guys taking care of any stations that that might benefit from the asymmetrical sideband power, or are yours pretty well straightforward, straight ahead, equal sideband power for your HDs?
One of our of the two FMs that we have at Buckley right now that are HD radio, excuse me, the station in Hartford is going to be limited to symmetrical minus 14 on each side because it's kind of boxed in many, many, many ways. The station in California is a grandfathered superpower B, so it is not eligible to go up at all. It's going to be sitting at minus 20.
Gotcha. Hey, Mr. Tarr, you got some HD stations out there. Are they all straight ahead?
Pretty much. I kind of laugh because we're talking about changing the sidebands less on one, more on another. You know, that's the whole thing we've been trained to prevent all this time with digital radio is, you know, with tilt correction and that sort of thing, is to eliminate that issue. I have one that will be used to straight ahead. I do have a superpower B that, although we can go up a little bit, we do have an immediate first adjacent not too far away that, you know, in practice it might work.
Gotcha. So, Hal, what? I didn't mean to cut you off there, Hal. What else do you have to report about these issues?
Well, when you control the peak-to-average ratio power reduction in the entire envelope, you can press a transmitter to do about 30% more power output than you can when it is operating in the conventional ubiquity historical algorithm. So that might mean a customer who is looking at going up in HD sideband power, or hasn't done HD at all yet, and is looking at a future rollout, he potentially could buy a smaller transmitter than he might have had to buy before that.
Well, and you're addressing this because this is one of the difficulties with HD radio and digital amplification is that because the algorithm provides sometimes that there are big peaks of power needed above the average. That you end up having to install a transmitter that'll handle the peaks when, you know, 99.9% of the time it's just doing the average amount of power.
Natively, it would be about 8 dB above the average.
8 dB is a lot.
If you put no peak reduction in there, the difference can be as much as 8 dB.
Wow. Okay, for us challenged in dB math, logarithmic math, give me an idea of...
Oh, that's got to be somewhere let's see. Well, 10 dB would be 10 times, so it's a little less than 10 times.
I thought 10 dB was 100 times. Are we talking about power?
Yeah, so 10 dB increase in power coincides mathematically with a 10 times increase. So it's less than 10 times, but not a lot less than 10 times.
Okay, maybe my math's wrong. I thought 3 dB was 2 times.
It is.
Okay, so but 10 dB is 10 times. All right.
It's not linear. It's a logarithmic function.
Yeah, yeah.
Tom Ray can explain it.
Maybe we'll have a session on that one time. Kirk's never been too good at logarithmic stuff.
I'll be happy to send you the calculations, Kirk, for the logarithmic stuff. It's not that difficult, but boy, if you get things out of place, you can mess it up in a hurry.
Hal, we're gonna wrap up with you. What else do you have to wrap your story up here about the situation at WAMU and progress that's made in these technical advances with HD?
Well, they installed a transmitter a few months back, earlier this year, and it. It was considerably larger than it needed to be for their analog power level. They specifically were intending to go up to be able to do the increased power for HD. So they've got lots of headroom in there. So it's going to be a great test bed for us to be able to put the new exciter on, which will have this enhanced PAPR system and HD power boost. So the testing will involve, for example, testing analog host interference with power boost on and off, coverage and bit error rate measurements, MERs, you know, that were discussed at NAB as a method of determining the quality of an iBox signal. So we will be able to AB that system and take tests in both ways. And we're very close to having an independent test lab. We're working with them. We're at the proposal stage right now where we're going back and forth on it. So we'll have an independent test lab who will also work with WAMU, and we'll be able to have an unbiased third party test report that won't be something. I mean, we'll be paying for it, but it will be commissioned to an independent lab, so it won't be our own test. It'll be their tests.
Gotcha. All right. Well, Hal, you'll be available to report back to us, won't you?
Absolutely. We could maybe do this again in the fall after we've got the tests in, and we can let you know.
All right. I'd be interested to see how that wraps up. And speaking of wrapping up, I know that Tom Ray had a little troubleshooting story to tell us about. Tom, you were did you get stung?
We have a station in Torrington, Connecticut, WSNG. It's a they're on 610, 1,000 watts day, 500 watts night with three towers that are top loaded. And they started having a problem with the directional. And what would happen was tower number one, which is the reference tower, would go kind of nutty, and the transmitter would shut down. And it only seemed to happen on hot days. So, of course, the first thing I thought of was, must be a bad capacitor. So, you know, mm-hmm. We went up to take a look at it. And this isn't a directional. It's got very. It's not very complicated. The tuning networks at the tower bases are very simple T networks: inductor with a shunt capacitor. Yeah. And it's one of the they're smaller mica capacitors. And we went out and we looked, and I'm looking, and I got the capacitor there. And I'm looking at the capacitor, and I'm not seeing anything oozing or anything wrong. And kind of scratched my head and. I'm talking to our chief engineer, Scott, and we're looking at this thing, and we're trying to figure out what could be going on. Well, that's when we turned around, and we saw this bee's nest just starting. It was about that big, up at the top of the door. Well, Scott took a stick and whacked the door, and when he whacked the door opened up, smacked into the transmission line, and lo and behold, the transmitter popped off the air.
Oh.
So we said, in that part of Connecticut, when it gets really hot, it tends to get a little windy. And I wonder if this transmission line, for whatever reason, is having a problem. Now, it was an older transmission line. It was made by Times Wire and Cable. It said it was RG8U, but it must have been 3/4 inch in diameter, which is way too big for RG8.
Yeah.
So we turned the transmitter back on and started doing things like kicking and shaking the transmission line where it went into the tuning house, and lo and behold, every time we wrapped it one, the transmitter would drop off. So we went in and we looked at the transmission line, and I said, don't like that. So we went to Home Depot, got some cable clamps, the copper cable clamps, and proceeded to take the we took the station off the air, proceeded to take the transmission line apart. And what we found is normally where this thing connects, you have the copper shield that goes around the insulation for the center conductor of the of the coax.
Yeah.
That, over time, that center conductor, and this is the end of the shield, that center conductor, but the insulation had pulled back. So
the
it was
insulation
about,
pulled back.
Yeah, it was about this far, maybe about an inch, maybe 2 inches, inside the outer braid. Which meant that the transmission line was going through thin air, or actually going through this copper braid with no insulation. And if you looked at it, there were these little hairs of copper sticking out from the braid. And every time you smacked the cable, of course, the cable would bounce, or if the wind blew, the cable would move slightly. One of these hairs would hit the center conductor, transmitter would pop off the air.
Wow.
And we scaled that back, and we, made it nice and pretty, and dressed it nice and dressed it properly. And if it weren't for smacking those bees and having the door fly open and hit the transmission line, we probably would have been out there for days.
Very hard to find a little problem, but the bees led you right to it.
Thank
That's
you
amazing.
Very much. First time bees have been helpful, let me tell you.
Hey, let's check in with Chris Tarr. Chris, you've done a little troubleshooting lately. I think you had a little anecdote to close us out on our show.
Yeah, and it also is a good story about, you know, being aware of the surroundings at your transmitter site. I had recently a situation where my transmitter building, and it timely because we just talked about this a couple weeks ago, it was getting really, really warm in there, and it shouldn't have. You know, I'd been there, you know, a week or two before, and all the filters were clean, and, you know, all the air coming in was nice and cool, and there was a lot of it. And so I was getting these alarms. I'm going, wow, you know, did a blower die? Yeah, I couldn't figure it out. So I get up there. I walk in, and it's stuffy in there, but all the blowers are going. And I'm looking around. I look to see the filters, and I can't see daylight through them. And I was like, yeah. And, I mean, these were filters that I just recently put in. And, well, it turns out that they're putting in a bunch of solar panels in the fields around the transmitter building. And, of course, that kicks up a whole lot of dust and dirt. And within a matter of a week or two, completely clogged the filters up. So I ended up having to replace the filters, and you know, now going up on a weekly basis to monitor to make sure that they're okay. But you know, that kind of goes along with a site like that transmitter site. You know, I may go up there once a month just to check on it and make sure it's okay unless there's a problem. So sometimes it kind of goes along with making sure you're on top of what's going on around your transmitter sites, because stuff like that can pop up, and before you know it, you've got a problem.
You know, when obvious things happen at a time that you wouldn't expect them, they're no longer obvious, are they?
Right, exactly. And, you know, and I learned something, that probably I need to, hop up there a little more than once a month just to make sure there's nothing else, not necessarily things going on in the building, but around the building, in case there's something going on that I need to know about.
Take a walk around the building and find all the snakes.
Exactly.
Hey, we're going to close the show out here. Hal, you're still with us?
I am.
Hey, thank you for being on the show. I appreciate your insights into the modern technology, HD radio, when, Tom is fighting bees and Chris is fighting dirt and air filters, and I'm just fighting having no money at a small station. It's interesting to hear about what's happening in the world of high technology, HD radio, and how we're getting the most we can, at least from the transmission end, out of this thing. So, Hal, when you get a chance to give us a report in the fall as to how things are going, with this, I'd really love to hear about it.
Will do, and thanks very much for having me on.
Okay, Hal. Take care. Yeah, give my regards to your colleagues. Chris Tarr, thanks for joining us from Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Thanks for having me. Don't forget to stop by my website, www.geekjedi.com.
I will. I haven't been there in a few weeks, so I'll stop by. And everybody else, too. That wasn't just for me. And Tom Ray, thanks for joining us from the Hudson Valley of New York. Appreciate you getting home and getting on the air with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Kirk. And by the way, I'll give your regards to Broadway.
Okay. That's right. You're there every day, aren't you?
There you go. I made it to Broadway. What can I tell you?
All right. And thanks to Burke back at the Twit Network. Thanks for joining us. Be sure you check out the website thisweekinradiotech.com, where you can see, I'll get pictures up and show notes from this episode. You can also subscribe to this podcast in the iTunes store. It's free and downloads every week automatically just as soon as it's published. We appreciate your comments, too, on our forums and in the show notes area. You can leave a comment there. Thanks for joining us. Please check us again next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.
That's all the bandwidth we can pill for this week. Another tort has propagated, and all the transmitters and audio equipment live happily ever after, thanks to the handsome engineer and his kind, benevolent care. We'll be back next week.
Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
This Week in Radio Tech.
Subscribe to iTunes and you'll never miss a show.
Search for This Week in Radio Tech in the iTunes store.
Soliciting is strictly encouraged. If you like today's show, tell a friend. If you didn't like it, we were never here. Kirk Harnack's wardrobe provided by the Salvation Army and the Red Cross Disaster Relief Services. Hair and makeup provided by Penelope Garcia Hernandez Weinberg.
He's unique, wouldn't you say?
I just want to get it over with.
This ends this transmission.
Tango, Whiskey, India, Romeo, Tango.
Signing off. Okay.